A dozen. Mission.
You're listening to This Week in Radio News. Radio news about radio waves, radio art, and more. I'm Tom Rowe, your host, and we'll travel across the ether to hear what's going on in radio news. This week on This Week in Radio, we're listening in on civilian deaths from radio-controlled drones. We'll tune in amateur radio from Nepal. We'll see if Norway is considering turning off FM radio. We'll listen to a baseball broadcast without a crowd, hear what A-Mark's opinion about World Press Freedom Day, and more. White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest detailed American policy about radio-controlled drones about as well as anyone in the administration does at a briefing last week, largely about the American killed in a drone attack on terrorists.
Well, Jeff, there are certain aspects of the specific operation that I'm not going to be able to discuss, including how the specific operation was carried out. But I can say as a couple of things as a general matter. The first is the president, and I had an opportunity to talk about this with him today, believes that his top priority is keeping the American people safe. And in this particular incident, it is particularly painful and tragic that in the course of carrying out an operation that was aimed at trying to protect the American public, that American citizen, an innocent American citizen, lost his life. And it highlights the challenge that our counterterrorism professionals confront every day in terms of balancing the need to use our significant capabilities to protect the American people with the need to carry out these operations consistent with the values that we hold dear in this country.
Can you address the issue of drones, though, in any way? I take it you don't want to confirm that that's what was used in this particular strike.
I'm not in a position to talk specifically about how the operation was carried out.
Can you talk, though, about the future review of drone strategy more generally?
What I can say is that these counterterrorism operations that are critical to the national security of the United States and critical to the safety of the American people continue. At the same time, there is an ongoing review both by our national security infrastructure and by an inspector general to review what occurred in this particular operation. And to make recommendations about some reforms to the protocols and policies that are in place that would make it less likely that an unintended consequence like this would crop up again.
Warren Weinstein, 73, of Rockville, Maryland, and an Italian hostage, killed in a January bombing from a radio-controlled drone targeting terrorists in Pakistan, President Obama said April 23rd. While the media in America were riled up by the death from above to one of its own, civilian death by drone is nothing unusual. Leah Labresco at 538.com details, as much as anyone could, the little data there is about civilian death from remote-controlled drone bombings. Drones killed between 421 and 960 civilians in Pakistan between 2004 and April 12, 2015, according to estimates from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, the story says. Statistics here are sketchy for many reasons. The U.S. government, for instance, does not count any men killed by bombings as civilians. The Long War Journal estimates that drones killed 156 civilians in Pakistan between 2006 and April 13, 2015. The New America Foundation guesses that between 2004 and April 12, 2015, 258 to 307 civilians were killed in Pakistan. The Columbia Law School Human Rights Clinic estimated that drones killed 72 to 155 civilians in Pakistan in 2011. So while this American's death was tragic, it was not alone among innocents killed by radio-controlled drones. Radio, whether local FM signals or longer-range shortwave transmissions, continue to be the most immediate way to exchange information in an emergency or disaster. Last week in Nepal, after a 7.8 magnitude earthquake left at least 4,000 dead, shortwave sounds played an important role in recovery efforts. Here, via the SW Elling Post blog, is one example.
2 hours. wear us out, you know. So on behalf of everyone, I want to thank you so much, Colin. You've been a great, great, great help, a great assistance to all of us. On behalf of the people in Nepal who, you know, the majority of them don't know still what we're doing. We'll thank you for now. We will wait for you as soon as you can let us know. If you'll be back tonight, that'll be perfect. I will try and gather a few more volunteers, for at least maybe for the next couple of days, and we'll set it according to some decent time where we have propagation between Europe and Asia. I will keep this frequency clear. We are waiting only now for a latest update. It's getting dark there, of course. It's almost 9:30 at night in Kathmandu. And as soon as I get more updates from Satish, I will bring it to you live. Colin, go get some sleep, get some food. I'll be here with DK3 Lima, Quebec. And I will move off frequency. Guys, I will be back in 2 minutes. I will move with you off frequency, and we will try to get more volunteers. And if you find anyone that you know that can help us, please have him contact me. Thanks again. Colin, good night. Thank you so much again.
Wikipedia says the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center in Manhattan in 2001, the 2003 North American blackout, and Hurricane Katrina in September of 2005 are three recent times in the United States when, quote, amateur radio was used to coordinate disaster relief activities when other systems failed, unquote. In March, Hurricane Pam destroyed much of the island of Vinuta, with Vinuta Net, quote, operating daily at 0730 local time, 2030 Zulu during cruising season on 8.230 with fallback frequency of 8.188. CNN's headline last week, Norway to become first nation in the world to shut down FM radio, was not quite true. First, the Norwegian Local Radio Association said besides the major stations, only 23 local radio stations will transition to DAB. NLF also said the Norwegian parliament requires 50% of the country already be listening to digital feeds before turning the analog signals off. Currently, only 19% of the country tunes in DAB broadcasts, and the analog switch-off still needs approval from Parliament. Paul Rimsmandale in Radio Survivor reports the shut-off has majority support, but opposition from the Progress Party and the Green Party say the change is only due to lobbying from Digital Radio Norge AS company, not by any consumer demand. Digital broadcasting there is well ahead of the United States, though, where 2 or 3% of the population can tune in digital radio, according to Rimsmandale in Radio Survivor. Quote, the country's topography is hard on analog radio signals. Its population density and distribution makes planning a network of DAB plus transmitters to serve the country a relatively straightforward exercise. And most importantly, Norway's radio industry isn't that large, and its most powerful constituents are public and state broadcasters, who've been quite supportive of digital radio from the outset, unquote. John Anderson in DIYmedia.net writes, the UK has 36.8% digital penetration, and most Norwegian broadcasters have upgraded to the newer DAB+, which means much better sound quality than in England. The United States are under a completely different format with major differences. HD radio, the format here, puts digital signals on analog frequencies, which usually two extra channels with sound quality issues. DAB, the chosen format by the rest of the world, sounds better and seems more adaptable. For instance, Ofcom, England's radio regulator, like the FCC, is now allowing community groups to apply for small-scale, standalone DAB stations akin to the digital version of low-power FM. Norway may not be turning off its FM transmitters anytime soon, but an all-digital future is probably inevitable. Gary Thorne called the seventh inning of the Baltimore Orioles game to Chicago White Sox April 29th because of civil unrest in the town after the funeral of a victim of at least overzealousness by local police. The game was played without an audience, leading to an unusual broadcast.
Because nobody's in the yard about the appropriate way to broadcast. So with Adam Jones coming up here in the seventh inning, Jones' approach to the plate with Carroll delivering. Jones will whack the son of a gun to center field. That's very deep. It's deep, and it's off the base of the wall. He will head to second base. Adam Jones has a double, And that green jacket is well within reach, Jim.
First baseman, number 19, Chris Davis.
That was our Masters voice.
Well, that's right. That ball was whacked. They don't whack a golf ball. But he whacked this one. I'm telling you. There you go. I knew you were going to do it.
Well, that was, look, I give credit. Dawn, our producer, she emails me this morning. She says, okay, what voice are you going to use? Will it be the Masters voice? Or will it be your free baseball for everybody voice? I have no idea. I hadn't had coffee yet. How did I know?
April 30th was World Press Freedom Day, and the World Association of Community Radio Broadcasters, AMARC, hoped that press freedom extends to the radio waves. AMARC launched its International Legal Protection and Global Advocacy Program on April 30th for community media and noted several recent attacks on radio press freedom. Quote, in 2014, Radio Estereo Luz and Radio La Voz de Sonora, located in Western Department of Quiche in Guatemala, have been shut down and their equipment have been seized. In Egypt, Internet Radio Hortna was recently persecuted because of illegal internet streaming. In April 2015, in Mexico, Abel Manuel Batista Raimundo, founder and director of Radio Espacio 96.1 FM in Juxtahaca in Oaxaca State, was murdered, unquote, AMARC wrote in a press release. They note that Swedish commercial stations currently occupy community radio frequencies there and say, quote, community radio licenses are becoming less a resource for nonprofit associations and more an opportunity for commercial operators who can circumvent the formal commercial radio sector and its official responsibilities, including concession fees to the government, unquote. AMARC is creating a legal office for, quote, frequency planning, technical standards for telecommunications and radio, and development resources for, unquote, for community media. Next up on This Week in Radio News, we tune in the House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology FCC reauthorization hearing called Improving Commission Transparency. FCC Chairman Tom Wheeler was on the hot seat once again in Congress on April 30th. Let's tune into some excerpts from the hearing.
If I have time, but I'm very concerned about transparency at the FCC, but I'm also very concerned about transparency with the ads that fill our airwaves every election season and even now after election season. So I introduced today the Keeping Our Campaigns Honest Act, legislation requiring the FCC to revise their sponsorship identification rules to take in super PACs and 501c4 organizations. We need to make sure that there is sunlight on these donors until the IRS issues a clearer ruling. So I appreciate the opportunity to just mention that's something I want to talk about in the future with the FCC and the committee. I yield back.
One of the reasons that we are going about this is because of the opaque process, which I think surrounded the net neutrality rules and really damaged the credibility of the commission. That is something that is regrettable, and we should not have to see things passed in order to find out what is in them. And we want to work with you on making certain things are more transparent.
I want you to know that I listened carefully to your opening statement, took the message you were delivering on board, and I also feel very strongly that impugning the First Amendment or this committee was in no way, shape, or form any goal, and I don't believe that I did. And so I just want to state that for the record.
I appreciate that.
Long before I ever came to the commission, I had heard of how the FCC must become more efficient and make decisions faster. It was a topic, Mr. Chairman, of our first meeting, you may recall. You prompted me to task a senior member of the chairman's office to lead an intra-agency team to attack the problem. The result of this has been the resolution of thousands upon thousands of pending matters, the most items ever resolved in the shortest period ever. We aren't done by a long stretch. But in regard to the issues raised by the three proposals noticed for this hearing, we should consider the following. Publishing our decisions quickly has been a priority of mine. During no other chairmanship in this century have we reported items as quickly as we have during my chairmanship. 73% in one business day or less. 86% in 2 days. But you ask, what about the other 14%? Well, those are 41 decisions that were typically the result of last-minute negotiations, and the staff had to work with the commissioners to bring them into shape. But let's let the facts speak for themselves. During my chairmanship, the average time to release an order was 1.8 days. Just for comparison's sake, during the Powell Commission, the average was 8.7 days. During the Martin Commission, the average was 10.7 days. On another topic, delegated authority, delegated authority on items for the FCC record is at a 15-year low during my chairmanship. And that's both in absolute numbers and in the ratio to overall decisions. Now, the interesting thing is that delegated authority can be confusing as a term. Last year, there were over 950,000 items that were decided on delegated authority. That may seem like a large number, but it has actually stayed pretty constant over the years. The vast majority of delegated authority decisions are routine, although they are of great importance to the companies affected. About 0.2% of those delegated authority decisions are substantive enough to make it into the FCC record, which is the compendium of commission policy matters. Again, the facts speak for themselves. If the goal is to reduce delegated authority decisions in order that commissioners vote on as many items as possible, the record during my chairmanship surpasses the record of Republican administrations affording that opportunity to minority commissioners. And finally, the commission has never been more open and the public more informed of our activities. While publishing the specific language being considered and debated by the commissioners may seem to facilitate matters, it actually achieves the opposite. Doing this would turn an open yet highly structured administrative process into something akin to the Funhouse mirror, Hall of Mirrors, where, you know, it just goes on and on and on and on. And this is because in Sprint Corporation v. FCC, the D.C. Circuit held that the Commission must respond in its decisions to every argument raised on the record. Now, there have been a lot of guffaws about a 300-page open Internet order accompanying 8 pages of rules. But that's why. By law, every issue raised in an extremely fulsome record had to be addressed. We can virtually guarantee that publishing a pre-decisional draft will trigger an influx of new comments raising new issues. Every imaginative lawyer on every side of an issue will dream up new interpretations, new contexts, and new issues that they'll file with the commission, to which the commission must respond. This means there would not be a decision, but a rewrite to reflect the new record. Then it would be published again, and the whole process would begin again as we dive down the administrative rabbit hole. But let's look for a moment at some examples. The Connect America Fund payments for rural rate of return carriers needs to be resolved. This is basically a debate among carriers who receive benefits over the best formula to calculate those payments. Some carriers will benefit from the change. Others won't. And those who feel disadvantaged will seize upon this as an opportunity to keep us from getting funds into the hands of those who can deliver broadband in rural areas. The designated entities competitive bidding issue is a hot item on which we've heard a great deal from this committee. But if we don't have rules in place in advance of the incentive auction in Q1 of next year, the old rules will stick. Neither of us want that. Likewise, however, if we get into this kind of a constant delay situation, then the alternative becomes, do we delay the auction? And neither of us want to do that either. So all I say, Mr. Chairman, is from our first meeting, you and I shared the same goal about improving the Commission's processes. Commissioner O'Reilly, my friend and colleague Mike O'Reilly, is also a champion of these efforts. He's made a number of very good and substantive suggestions that prompted me to create an all-offices task force to review just how the agency operates. I believe in making the FCC more efficient and nimble, and I look forward to working with you in that goal.
I appreciate that. And I thank you for your testimony and your comments and your leadership at the FCC. Let's go now to Commissioner O'Reilly. We appreciate you being here and your testimony and comments, sir, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Ranking Member Eshoo, and members of the subcommittee. Thank you for the opportunity to discuss this important topic before you today. Having served at the FCC for nearly 18 months, I've experienced FCC procedures and assessed their effects firsthand. Over the years, I've also had the opportunity to speak with stakeholders about areas for improvement. Consequently, I believe that a number of FCC practices are in need of review and reform. My pursuit of greater commission transparency is not related to any particular issue, such as net neutrality. My interest is in improving our overall processes far preceded that specific order, and the areas I've highlighted are reoccurring problems that have been developing over some time, not to this particular commission. Some people have interest in comparing the procedures of other independent federal agencies. I'm not sure that process will be very enlightening because each agency comes with its own operating statute that can differ tremendously for numerous reasons. The standard for considering any proposed change should be, in my mind, what is in the best interest of the American people and the communications marketplace. I also disagree that the APA requires practices to be the same across all agencies. That is not the case today and cannot justify inaction. Likewise, it's no excuse that new procedures may take time to implement. The agency routinely reviews and updates its rules for regulatees, and we can do the same for our own processes. Since you've invited me to testify before you, I will say that I am in favor of the legislative efforts underlying the three draft bills that are under discussion. Vice Chairman Latta's bill would ensure that commissioners and the public know when items are being debated are being decided under delegated authority. Today, I am given up to 48-hour notices in some cases, but in most instances, no notice at all, which is harmful for purposes of following and acting on related issues. This fix is not something to be feared. And the argument made by some that opposing the bill that such a list would prevent the commission from slipping out items not unnoticed is problematic from my viewpoint. I also disagree with the notion that parties aggrieved by a Bureau decision can simply seek Commission review. There is no timing required for the Commission to act on an application for review. A number of them have been pending for years, meaning I get no involvement. In regards to Congresswoman Elmer's bill, posting the adopted rules within 24 hours would allow the public and stakeholders access to the bottom lines instead of having to wait, in some cases weeks, for the item to be completed. Such delay hinders their preparation to either to comply or challenge the item in court, meaning additional time for market uncertainty. Congressman Kinzinger's bill would greatly improve the ex parte meetings at the commission by allowing outside parties to know what is actually being contemplated so they can target their areas of concern. It is frustrating, so frustrating, to sit in a meeting unable to actually engage with parties or talk about what changes I am seeking to an item or how best to fix a particular problem. More transparency would not reopen the comment period or interfere with the deliberative process. Parties already file ex parte during the circulation period. This simply ensures that their comments are on point and that our deliberations are informed by their views. In rare instances, it may take some additional time, while still under the sunshine period, to finalize an item, but that would not create an undue delay and may ultimately save time by avoiding the need to reconsider or litigate decisions that were not fully baked. I know discussion of reform has generated some concern that minority commissioners might grind the commission to a halt. Not only is that not my intent, I do not believe it is any way accurate. Additionally, these changes would not undermine the discussions or interfere with negotiations between commissioners' offices. In addition to the three bills under discussion, my written testimony provides additional areas that I hope will be considered by the subcommittee. These include selectively elevating delegated authority items to the full commission upon request, the editorial privileges process, the pre-adoption process, testimony provided by outside witnesses at commission open meetings, the role of advisory committees, compliance with the Paperwork Reduction Act and Regulatory Flexibility Act, accounting for Enforcement Bureau assessed penalties, and codifying all FCC procedures. In sum, I believe the changes should be made to the Commission's proceedings in order to improve its efficiency, transparency, and accountability. And I thank you very much.
Those were excerpts from the U.S. House Subcommittee on Communications and Technology, Thursday, April 30th, called FCC Reauthorization, Improving Commission Transparency. This is Tom Rove for This Week in Radio News from Wave Farm and WGXC in upstate New York.